Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Chad Marlowe, senior policy counsel with the ACLU, who warns that Donald Trump's National Security Memo 7 poses an unconstitutional threat to the president's political opponents, freedom of speech, and democracy itself. Peggy Bailey of the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, who examines the Trump regime's unprecedented attempt to block SNAP food assistance to the nation's poor families during the government shutdown. And artist and activist Robert Shetterly, creator of the Americans Who Tell the Truth Portraiture Project, honoring those who fought for justice, equality, and democracy, who talks about his goal of inspiring courageous citizenship. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
3 years after Russia's February 2022 invasion of Ukraine, it's estimated that over 1 million people on both sides have been killed or injured in the war. Whole towns have been flattened and infrastructure destroyed, leading to almost 6 million people displaced internally and 5.7 million refugees taking shelter in neighboring European countries. But the Grist reports an additional casualty of the war is Ukraine's ravaged environment and natural resources. Over 5 million acres of Ukraine's forest land have burned adjacent to conflict zones ignited by artillery shells, mines, and other explosive devices. Uncontrolled forest fires are a threat to many Ukrainians who flee to forests seeking refuge from the war. These fires account for a third of all of Ukraine's carbon emissions. A collective of forestry scientists in Ukraine and from abroad have begun working together to study war-driven wildfires and other forest destruction, as well as to map unexploded ordnance that pose a long-term danger to the population and environment. Among their goals is to improve the deployment of firefighters and other resources to save the forests, a dangerous job in the midst of a brutal war. Ethiopia opened its new Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam in mid-September. The massive dam took 14 years to build at a cost of $5 billion over the objections of Egypt, which had controlled the flow of the Nile's waters for decades. The new dam, Africa's largest, will double Ethiopia's power generation and provide electricity to 60 million Ethiopians who currently lack power. The nation will now be in position to export electricity to Kenya, Tanzania, and Djibouti. Ethiopia expects to make $427 million in export revenue annually from the megadam. While Egypt relies on the Nile for almost all of its freshwater supply, some 80% of the river's waters originate in Ethiopia. Egypt, which says that the new dam jeopardizes its water security, previously threatened military intervention against Ethiopia to stop its construction. The dam dispute has the potential to stoke tensions throughout the Horn of Africa, where Ethiopia also faces a looming conflict with Eritrea over access to the Red Sea. Conservationists and environmentalists are concerned that the planned expansion of Donald Trump's federally funded border wall along the U.S.-Mexico frontier can stop or deter the migration of vital pollinators such as bees and butterflies. The nearly 2,000-mile-long border between the U.S. and Mexico is often regarded as barren, but it's the site of several highly biodiverse regions that are home to hundreds of species of mammals, reptiles, birds, and insects. Some pollinators, like the monarch butterfly, have exclusive relationships with certain plants, meaning if they don't pollinate them, nothing else will. Inside Climate News reports that Trump regime plans to build 100 miles of new barriers and install miles of harsh stadium lighting that researchers say will either attract or push away insects, are both problematic. There's also worry about the wall's impact on large mammals, such as jaguar, migration patterns. Globally, many pollinator species are declining due to threats, including habitat destruction and fragmentation, climate change, and pesticides. Already, more than 70 pollinating species are listed as endangered or threatened in the U.S., according to the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As Donald Trump deploys National Guard troops to Democratic Party-run cities across the country, he's taken other radical steps to consolidate his authoritarian rule by defying and circumventing the U.S. Constitution's establishment of three co-equal branches of government to act as a check on abuses of power. On September 22nd, not long after the assassination of far-right leader Charlie Kirk, Trump signed an executive order designating Antifa as a domestic terrorist organization, despite the fact that it's a decentralized movement whose only unifying ideology is its opposition of fascism and far-right extremism, lacking membership roles in a leadership hierarchy. Just 3 days later, Trump issued National Security Presidential Memorandum 7, which authorizes the FBI's National Joint Terrorism Task Forces to investigate, prosecute, and disrupt entities and individuals engaged in acts of political violence and intimidation, targeting nonprofits, activists, and their donors and funders labeled anti-American, anti-capitalist, and anti-Christian. Civil liberties groups have expressed alarm at Trump labeling his critics and political opponents engaged in protected First Amendment activities as domestic terrorists, which clearly seeks to criminalize dissent. Your reporter spoke with Chad Marlowe, senior policy counsel with the ACLU, who warns that Trump's National Security Memo 7 poses an unconstitutional threat to the president's political opponents, freedom of speech, and democracy itself.
To most people, to most of your listeners, they may not be familiar with what we refer to as NSPM 7. But I think what they are very familiar with is that the President of the United States has very little tolerance for people who do not share and fully embrace his views and are not enthusiastically supportive of his agenda and him personally. And so in that light, him handing down a memorandum instructing the federal government, in particular the Attorney General and the Secretaries of State, Treasury, and Homeland Security, to identify nonprofits and charitable foundations whose work does not completely align and take a gentle knee to Trump and his agenda as, you know, what he will refer to as people who are promoting domestic terrorism and political violence. But I do think you and your listeners and a lot of people out there realize that this is Trump just trying to pound a square peg into a round hole, which is to say that he still has enough acumen, I think, to not say, I'm going to bring the entire force of the federal government down on anyone who dares disagree with me. So he couches it in these vague terms, as you point out, like terrorism and political violence, knowing that when it comes to enforcement, loose terms equal latitude. And so that gives him the opportunity to go after whoever he wants to tie into those groups. You know, one of the things that that the memorandum specifically references as the type of politically motivated terrorist acts that he's going to clamp down on, so you're expecting big things, he includes trespassing. He includes civil disobedience, which he calls civil disorder. And in order to rope in nonprofits and charitable institutions, he says it's not only people who engage in those acts, but people who in any way support them, inspire them, talk about them. And so that is kind of the world that we're looking at is, you know, anyone who attempts to organize a protest can come into the bullseye of this. Any nonprofit who attempts to go out and support people who want to have a conversation about the direction of our country and, God forbid, may have an issue with the direction it's going, those, unfortunately, are all in the crosshairs of this memorandum.
You wrote an article titled, "Governors and Mayors Can Protect Nonprofits from Trump's National Security Memo, NSPM-7, that labels his opponents as domestic terrorists." Tell us a bit about your advice to governors and mayors of cities who can do something to be proactive to defend citizens who are just exercising their constitutional rights from the effects of this memo.
One of the interesting things that appears in this memorandum is an acknowledgement that the people who are effectuating it, in particular, as you mentioned, the Joint Terrorism Task Force, who are kind of leading the effort, are going to have to work with state and local law enforcement in order to get what they need to go after these nonprofits and charitable institutions. That's not because they want to work with state and local entities. It's because they have to. Because a lot of the on-the-ground enforcement capabilities, and even more important, the information they need to try to dig up some pretextual reason to go after these, are in the hands of state and local governments. And this can be everything from highly sensitive and kind of on its face troubling surveillance data, but it can also be, you know, driver's license information, tax records, business information, employee information. And so what we're saying to governors and mayors is, if this concerns you, if what Trump is doing with this memorandum concerns you, you can do something about it right now. And what they can do is they can sign an executive order that says, if it's a governor, my state, if it's a mayor, my municipality will not cooperate with this order. If you have any inclination that the information that you're being asked for is to go after nonprofits or charitable institutions or their donors, their members, their employees, their leaders, anyone, you are to say no. If they actually have a case to make, let them go to judges. Let them go to the courts and convince a judge that this isn't a political witch hunt. Governors and mayors can do this right now. The ACLU has written model executive orders for governors and model executive orders for mayors. All they have to do is call up their state affiliate and ask for a copy. We'll get it to them immediately, and they can start protecting people today. But, you know, there is no single thing that any of us can do to completely wipe out the power of this presidential memorandum, but they are absolutely things that our governors and mayors can do to make it far more difficult to effectuate. And I think we all need to be asking our governors and mayors, one, do you think this is a problem? And two, do you have the courage to do something about it? And all it requires them to do is lift up the most powerful weapon in the arsenal of democracy, and that is their pens, and sign an executive order. And people will be safer the minute after they do so than they were the minute before.
That was Chad Marlowe, Senior Policy Counsel with the ACLU. Find more analysis and commentary on Trump's repressive National Security Memo 7 by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the federal shutdown entered Day 35, President Trump threatened to defy a federal court order requiring the administration to use a contingency fund to continue paying for Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program benefits, or SNAP, to some 42 million recipients, about 1 in 8 Americans across the nation. On November 4th, the president posted a message on his social media account stating he would ignore an order from Judge John McConnell Jr. of the U.S. District Court in Rhode Island to restore full or partial SNAP benefits. But only hours later, White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt revised the president's comments, telling reporters that the administration is fully complying with the court and would provide partial food stamp payments in November. Trump's Agriculture Department could have used additional funds to provide full benefits to those enrolled in the food stamp program, but the agency declined to do so. As a result, families will receive about half as much in funds to purchase food this month than they ordinarily get, and possibly only after weeks or months of delay. Your reporter spoke with Peggy Bailey, Executive Vice President for Policy and Program Development with the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, who talks about the Trump regime's unprecedented attempt to block SNAP food assistance to the nation's millions of poor families and possible solutions to end the ongoing government shutdown.
While the administration has been saying that they don't have a way to pay SNAP benefits in November, that is not true. Actually, there is a contingency fund that's available for their use for instances just like this. And not only is it available, but they're legally required to use these funds in the case of an emergency, such as during the government shutdown. And the administration has said, okay, since the courts are telling us we have to use these dollars, we will. One of the key problems, though, is that there's only about $6 billion in the contingency fund. And we know that SNAP benefits in November will cost about $9 billion. So there's a gap there. So right now, the administration is saying, yes, we will adhere to what the court is telling us, and we will use these SNAP contingency funds. It's going to take us a second because we've got to help states understand how much money they're going to receive, given that they're not going to receive the full $9 billion. Unfortunately, the administration isn't taking the next step, which would be to use other resources at their disposal to fill in that gap. Just because the contingency fund doesn't fill the gap doesn't mean the administration doesn't have other ways to be able to meet the whole $9 billion that's needed and make sure families stay whole with their food assistance benefits. And I want to make really clear that this is the first time this has ever happened. There hasn't been another time where we haven't met the challenge and paid full benefits to families for SNAP and made sure that families were able to afford groceries. So this is historic, and we're hoping that even though the administration will pay this partial benefit, they'll reconsider and fill in the gap so that families will receive their whole month of November benefits.
Thank you for that. And I did want to ask you about sort of the overall picture, Peggy. The ongoing government shutdown was triggered by Senate Democrats' refusal to vote for a temporary funding bill for the federal government unless President Trump and the Republicans made a deal to restore important subsidies for the Affordable Care Act health insurance plans. And without these subsidies, individual and family monthly health insurance premiums will skyrocket. They'll rise anywhere, I've read, between 75 and 114%, meaning millions won't be able to pay for their health insurance anymore. A lot of people without health insurance. And these people, if they get sick, they're going to go to the emergency room. It's going to cost either way. It's a complicated situation, but on the other hand, it's kind of simple.
Exactly.
Peggy, how should this shutdown be resolved, in your opinion?
I think, Scott, you hit on the point that this is actually quite simple. It wouldn't take much for Congress to agree that we should extend the enhanced premium tax credits that people have been receiving for the last few years to help them afford their health insurance. Hopefully Congress will realize that we can do all of the things. We can keep the government open. We can extend these premium tax credits, the enhanced premium tax credits. So the people who have been getting their tax credits since the beginning of the Affordable Care Act will still continue to get them. During the pandemic, Congress and the president expanded eligibility and deepened the premium tax credits for people. And it's that piece that we're debating right now. And another key part of keeping the government open is Congress putting in guardrails that say to the administration that a deal is a deal, that when we decide to appropriate dollars, the administration is required to spend them. And that refers to what has also been happening since January, where the administration has illegally either not spent money, illegally let go of federal employees, illegally stopped entire government programs, and has threatened to move rescission packages through Congress in ways that we also are at least legally suspect, if not some of them are also illegal themselves. And so in this shutdown, Congress needs to do all of the things, protect against those illegal actions that the administration has been taking to not spend money that Congress has appropriated, extend the premium tax credit enhancements, and that all of that can help keep the government open. In this country, we can do multiple things at once, and we shouldn't pit people against each other, whether it's people who need food assistance, people who are eligible for these premium tax credit enhancements, or all those that are being hurt by government funding being illegally taken back. We need to be able to do all these things at once.
That was Peggy Bailey, Executive Vice President for Policy and Program Development at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. Learn more about the Trump regime's slow-walking orders to restore SNAP food benefits to the nation's poor families during the government shutdown by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Robert Shetterly was one of thousands of young Americans in the late 60s and 70s who moved back to the land, becoming self-sufficient, building a home, raising food, and living off the grid. He lived in Maine and supported himself through a variety of jobs while teaching himself to paint. Eventually, Shetterly was able to make a living as a commercial artist. But almost 25 years ago, he painted a portrait of Walt Whitman to express his outrage about the U.S. government's invasion of Iraq. That set him on a course to create an ever-growing gallery of portraits called Americans Who Tell the Truth, to inspire what he calls courageous citizenship. His project, which channels the power of art to illuminate the ongoing struggle to realize America's democratic ideals, offers a variety of ways to engage with its portraits through both exhibits and educational programs. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Shetterly about his personal development as a portrait painter and discusses his goal of inspiring courageous citizenship.
My life changed in regard to this project and portrait painting in the run-up to the Iraq War right after 9/11. I was so angry, so frustrated, so alienated from this country because of the line that was going on to produce that war and the fact that the major media was letting them get away with it, that I thought I either had to leave the country or I had to do what I do best, which is paint, to somehow have a voice at that time. And I also knew, and this was very important, that it was not going to do anybody any good, me or anybody who would look at what I was doing, if I just showed how angry I was, if I just showed how full of grief I was. I realized that I had to take all that negative energy and use it in a positive way. And I couldn't, for some time, figure out what to do. And then it occurred to me, well, why don't I just surround myself with portraits of people who make me feel good about this country and good about the struggle to have this country live up to its own values. And that's where the project started. And that's when I taught myself how to paint portraits. And I began with a portrait of Walt Whitman. I thought I'd paint 5 or 6 portraits and that would be it. It was really a therapy project at the beginning, just to find a way to come to terms with being in a country that was committing war crimes. And so I did that, and it all of a sudden the reaction to them was so much stronger when I showed them the first few portraits than I expected. And there was immediately an awful lot of people who were feeling the same nostalgia for a country they thought they lived in than I was. And soon I was getting invited to bring the portraits into schools and talk about them, go to libraries and talk about them. And it just kept growing from there.
How many have you painted up to now?
It's around 280. I think I'm sort of lost count at the moment. I mean, I think it's a little over 280. There are a few new ones that I haven't put up on the website yet. We have quite a team now a little staff that works on the website and writes bios and arranges for the educational work. And, all the different things that have spun out of this project have really made it a much bigger thing than it was originally. I mean, the portraits travel all over the country to museums and colleges and libraries and community centers, churches, as much as possible. I trundle after them and talk about who the people are and why I painted them and what they mean for all of us in terms of maintaining a level of democratic sanity. And pretty soon I was being invited places and people were paying me to speak and that kind of thing. And it gradually has developed into, I mean, I don't make much money, but I survive. And that's all I want. I mean, what I want is to be able to keep on doing this and keep painting these pictures and keep telling the stories, to, especially to kids. Because the object of it now in schools is to inspire what we call, you know, courageous citizenship, to present these models of people who are not superheroes. You know, they're regular folks with flaws in their lives who did a courageous thing or things, you know, to try to make more justice in the world.
I was scanning through them, you know, after we set up this, the interview, you know, I knew, I would say certainly more than half, but then there were others I didn't know. I don't know. Can you say more about the process by which you picked the people?
Sure. I mean, at the beginning, it was, I was picking all these 19th century icons. You know, after Walt Whitman, I painted Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman and Susan B. Anthony and Mother Jones and Jane Addams, you know, just like that. People that most of us know. Although I was discovering that I knew them as names and I knew a name attached with an issue, but I knew nothing about their lives, really. I was, you know, having to read all these biographies to find out who these people really were and how complicated their lives often were and what their struggles were. Once it started to get a little notoriety, I was being bombarded, and I still am, with suggestions and requests. You know, why haven't you painted so-and-so? So-and-so is often somebody I've never heard of. I mean, if I look at my own gallery, I didn't know these people either. You know, I mean, I've been doing an awful lot of reading, but also I get so many suggestions, and often the suggestions are incredible about stories we should have been taught in middle school or high school or college about our own history. Because often these barely known people have had huge effects on our history.
That was Robert Shetterly, creator of the Americans Who Tell the Truth Portrait Gallery and Education Project. Learn more about the project by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPPM in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, KHOI in Ames, Iowa, KBCS in Bellevue, Washington, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.